Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
I felt like a spokesperson for the culture.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This week, we talk to Paul Wall. Paul is the Houston-based rapper, and sometimes jeweler, who rose to fame after his appearance on Mike Jones' 2004 hit, Still Tippin'. That tune, and Paul's own hit songs that followed, moved his hometown from hip-hop's periphery to its center. A shift which still reverberates today, as you can hear in the heavy H-Town influence on newer rappers like Drake and A$AP Rocky. Paul got his start as part of a group with his childhood friend Chamillionaire. After two albums as a duo, Paul went solo in 2004. He found success the following year on his city's famed Swisher House label with his album The People's Champ, which contained the hit Sittin' Sideways. Paul has continued to make music true to his city's roots while keeping a hand in any number of side hustles, from custom grills to clothing to his brand new strain of marijuana. We talked to him when he visited New York City to promote his new album, Slab God. If you enjoyed The Cipher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you'll want to check out episode 104, where we talk to a true H-Town rap legend, Scarface. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. And now, here's Paul Wall, baby.
So, Paul, I guess I wanted to start by going sort of all the way back to like 96, 97, you're like 15 years old, and you start getting involved in street promotion for like Def Jam. And then what was the story behind that? Why did you start to do that? Was it always like you knew you wanted to be a rapper and this was a way in?
I used to go to the clubs, and of course I was too young to get in the clubs, but we still would go. We paid a bouncer $10 extra or something, telling we left our ID at home. And coming out the club, there'd always be, and at the clubs, I love, you know, at a young age going to the club, you just mesmerized by everything that's going on because you just young. So everything you see is new to you and fresh. So you just inspired by everything. And I remember just I always would hang out in the DJ booth and ask the DJs to give me shout outs. You know what I'm saying? Because they give me a shout out on the mic. I felt like I was the man. And then, you know, leaving out the club, I'd always see people passing out either flyers or posters or passing out snippet tapes or something. Or when I'd be hanging out in the DJ booth, I'd see people bringing records, vinyl to the DJs or putting posters up or just, you know, stuff like that. And I just thought that was a cool job. You know, the people that did it, I thought I had a cool job. You know what I'm saying? Like, damn, that's a pretty dope job. I was young, too, at the time, so I had a lot of energy. I could stay out, you know, hours upon hours, do whatever. I'd go on the other side of town, do whatever I had to do. So, you know, my boy 5'4", who used to, he had a lot of accounts. He took me under his wing, showed me how to do stuff, him and my boy Ace. And that's just how it all started for me.
Nice. And so from there, you know, you did it for a bunch of labels. And then from there, how'd you hook up with Swisher House and start doing that stuff for them?
It was the same thing for Swisher House. Swisher House used to, Michael Watts and Ron C used to throw these parties on my side of town, like in my neighborhood.
For more information about Michael Watts and Swisher House, check out his visit to The Cipher in episode 62.
And Michael Watts DJed on the radio. Both of them DJed on the radio station. So it was like, man, you know, I just wanted to be down with them. So I would pass out flyers for them. They knew I did promotions for other people because they would always see me out. And then I started doing promotions for their parties, just passing flyers out at different high schools or malls or the high school football games or different events and stuff just to get people to come to the parties. And the parties was live. I could be 1,500, 2,000 people every week. And we was in high school, so we thought we was going down. We were making some money, but not even the money. Just we were figuring a lot of things out on how to do promotion and just do stuff. And, you know, so that's how I teamed up with Swisher House because I just wanted to do promotion for them too. And, of course, you know, they were known around my neighborhood for you know, having Snoop Dogg and Lil Mario and, you know, everybody else in the Swisher House. So I already knew who they were, listened to them. They were already, you know, heroes to me, you know what I'm saying, just because they were from the city and they were representing and they were coming hard with it. So getting down with them on the rapping side was just, I ain't gonna lie, man, I never really took my rapping, like, I looked at it like a dream to go to the NBA. Like, it don't really happen too often. So I was pretty realistic about, man, what is my plan B? What is my plan C? And, you know, what else am I going to do? You know, rapping was really just something I did for fun, you know.
Wow. And so you spent, you know, you're hanging out with them. And then it wasn't until 99 that you actually ended up on a mixtape.
What's happening, Mike Watts? I'm rocking Reebok with some white socks. Paul Wall be wrecking the mic while Michael Watts be chopping the rice. Chopping your block up with Big Dough. We about to go hit us a licks. You best to quit running your mouth, because my gorilla's been known to kick, though. I'm Paul Wall, camouflage.
Was there a period there where you were asking to get on, or you'd do a verse and it wouldn't end up on tapes? Or?
Man, I didn't really ask to get on, because me, I was just more... I was happy with just being affiliated and being down as a DJ, because I was DJing too at the time. And my dream was to be a DJ. You know, rapping was something I did, but I never thought at all that it would take me to where it took me. So I thought DJing was more realistic, because I could DJ every week. The DJs outlast the rappers. Rappers usually come with one or two albums and then fizzle out. Or, you know what I'm saying? You don't see, like, every rapper don't last forever. You know, it's not a good career length on average, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But DJing, man, I knew a lot of DJs who had been doing it for a long time and who still are, you know, so I thought that was a more realistic job of, man, I could do this forever and still be a part of something I love. I would DJ for a lot of different Swisher House parties or Swisher House events and stuff, and I just, at the time, man, I really loved Cash Money at the time, man. The Hot Boys, Juvenile, and BG. And Manny Fresh, man, his beats was just, man, phenomenal. And I didn't really hear no one rapping on him on the Swisher House tapes. So one time I seen Michael Washington, I was like, I was outside of the record store. I was at the record store to put up posters for some Def Jam artist or something. And Michael Watts was there dropping off wholesale tapes. And I just chopped it up with him a little bit. He was my boy, so I would talk to him all the time anyway. And I just was like, hey, man, I've been meaning to ask you, why y'all never freestyle on no Cash Money beats? And Michael Watts knew I rapped because we were in a rap group, but you got to realize at that time, it was a long waiting list of people trying to get on Swisher House tapes to rap.
I can imagine.
Yeah, so it was like, and then too, it was a lot of internal things going on that would prevent people from getting on tapes. Like, if you do something, you get on a tape, and then you go around and tell everybody, yeah, man, I wrecked the tape, and then get back, then you probably going to get taken off, because they didn't like people telling, Michael Watts did not like people telling that they got on tape before it came out, or saying that they came over there and wrecked everybody to Swisher House. Nah, you ain't wreck us. So, you know, he would take them off the tape, you know what I'm saying? So
tell your friends about that.
Yeah. So I was, you know, I didn't really expect to get on the Swisher House tape. I was happy just being affiliated. But Michael Watts knew I rapped, me and Chameleon, that we were in a group. At the time, you know, we really just were in a little crew together, me, him, and a few other people. We all rapped together. And Michael Watts, he said, well, which one were you talking about? I said, well, I don't know. Maybe that Cash Money is an Army, that BG. I love that beat, man.
Cash Money is an Army, nigga. Uneven, nigga. So if you ever try to harm me, nigga, it ain't grieving, nigga. Cash Money is an Army, nigga.
I don't know why nobody rapped to that. And he just started like doing the beat, like not really beatboxing, but just making the beat. And he was like, damn, yeah, you're right. That is a hard beat, man. Because he thought about it. He's like, yeah, that is a hard beat. And he was like, man, well, what would you say? He called me out. And I just started, I bust the flow. He was doing the beat. And it was like on some real shit where he was, like, he wasn't beatboxing, but he making the beat. Boom, 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 boom. Boom, 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 boom. That's how the beat go. Something like that. And he doing that. And I'm freestyling outside of a music store. You know, that was like my audition. And he was like, well, come on, man. We're going to the studio right now. And I hopped in the car with him. We went to the studio. I laid like two or three flows to that one, to Bling Bling. To something else. And all of them. Another thing that would happen is, Michael Watts would just lose the stuff. Well, he don't remember what he did with it. Because he had so many different boards and machines and folders. And we didn't go to school to learn how to do this stuff. You know what I'm saying? We just learned as we went. So we learned by mistake a lot of times. So, you know, none of them flows made it onto the tapes. And then eventually, not because they were whack or nothing like that. I don't know. Maybe they were. I don't know. So I was just like, damn, man, that's dope. I'm on these tapes, but don't nobody know, man. Damn, that's dope, man. I'm on these tapes wrecking, but I'm on these freestyles, but, man, don't nobody know. And you can't really tell nobody. You start telling people, then you for sure ain't getting on the tape.
Right.
So it was like, damn, man. It was like you caught in the between the rock and the hard place. But eventually, though, we had this idea. Me and Kamina was like, man, why don't we do a freestyle for Michael Watts, an intro for his radio show? Because that's something that a lot of DJs were asking us for here and there that we mess with, like DJs in Dallas or wherever. They would just ask for, you know, do us an intro. Even if, you know, they never heard of you before, sometimes they want you to do a freestyle because it's just the intro for their radio show. They like that. So we had an idea, man, why don't we do this for Watts, man? If we do this, maybe he'll play it. You know, what if he played it one time? Man, he'll play us on the radio. Man, you know, we just thought that was the shit. So we did the intro for him. Watts loved it. And then Watts ended up, was like, man, you know what? I'm going to do something I never did before. He jumped on it. He rapped on it to himself.
They call me Big Watts. Homestead is where you'll find them. Lost it. Hate me. Find me. But they can't stop me. All about making the come up. I'm busting on niggas that run. Gotta stay real. Gotta make me a meal. Gotta roll in the legs. That's bubbed.
And he was like, man, I think I'm going to rap on it. And me and Camille was like, shit, hell yeah. Because I thought it would be dope. Because first of all, DJ Screw used to rap lots of times, and some of his verses were the most classic verses. And I thought that was so dope that he was a DJ and he could spit if he wanted to. You know, his DJ skills was unmatched by anybody that I ever met.
Yeah, Screw used to mix a lot of his stuff live, right?
Yeah.
Houston rap expert Lance Scott Walker, our guest on episode 59, wrote about DJ Screw's mixtape making process in his article, DJ Screw, A Fast Life in Slow Motion. Screw would have two copies of the same record spinning on the turntables, one playing just behind the other, and he'd chop back and forth between them with his crossfader at moments he wanted to bring out, scratching and running records back to repeat phrases and double up beats, sometimes dragging a finger alongside the wheel to give it a warble. He had his fader set to hamster style, the reverse of most turntable setups, so that he could make quicker stabs between the discs. This would all be recorded live to tape, with Screw knowing exactly how long he could record for and still stretch it out to fill one side of a 100-minute Maxell Gray cassette. Then he'd run that recording back through the tape deck, slowing it down with a 4-track pitch control and taking the tape down another generation.
And then he, same with the freestyle, come on in and freestyle live. You know, so just that the respect level was just like, man, that respect was like, man, out of this world. So, of course, I was like, shit, Michael Watts ain't never freestyled before. Hell yeah, I'd love to be on the freestyle with him. You know, shit, whereas a lot of the other Swish House artists was like, man, hell nah, Watts, you ain't rapping on this. You know what I'm saying? just because he wasn't known for rapping. Well, I was like, shit, just give him a shot. That might be dope. Shit, he gave me the shot, you know what I'm saying? And I still remember, too, man, at times where it would be people who didn't want us rapping on Swish House tape. Because there's a lot of people in the Swish House. Swish House kept getting bigger and bigger. So, naturally, eventually, it gets to a point where it's like, damn, how many more people are we going to get in the Swish House? But, you know, me and Camille now, they really didn't want us. I don't say they, but it was a few people that didn't want us in the Swish House. So, Michael Watts, really, that pushed Michael Watts over the edge to put us on the tapes. Because he was like, man, y'all don't run this. This is my shit. I'm running the Swish House. I decide who gets on the tapes. You know, not y'all. This is my Swish House tape. It's my house. We at my Swisher house, you right. know. So he put us on the tapes, and you know, man, it changed our life for real.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because you had this kind of weird trajectory. You were like the kid passing out flyers, and then you're an artist. And I was curious, like, how the other artists react to that. And I guess not always well.
Well, you know, when you're passing out flyers, they look at you like you the guy that's passing out flyers. You know what I'm saying? When you rap, they look at you like you the superstar on stage. So passing out flyers is like it's looked at by a lot of people as being like a scrub position, or you know, with me, I just thought it was a cool position. I like, you know, I like doing the job. I liked what it was, you know, and I like being a part of something, and I like being able to support someone. And I just learned a lot. I like meeting people. So passing out flyers, you meeting people, all different type of things. I was, you know, I did things with flyers that the other people passing out flyers weren't doing. And, you know, put them in places other people weren't doing them. And the next thing you know, everybody got them in the same place I got my flyer. You know, just different things like that. So, you know, I wasn't really humble, you know, was no question. Of course I was humble. I didn't, you know, it didn't matter to me if you was passing out flyers or if you was, you know, Slim Thug. I still treated people the same with the same amount of respect and interest level in the conversation we having, or just whatever, just treat them with respect. But, you know, like you say, man, a lot of people don't act the same way, man, you know, especially – you go from passing out flyers to rapping. A lot of people, they just like, man, why you got the flyer guy passing on here rapping? You know, but even though I was a rapper, I could spit the whole time. It just
right.
They didn't know me for that. They knew me as being the flyer guy. So you know, hey man, it is what it is.
Yeah. And so you and Chamillionaire, you kind of hinted at before, we're in this like color changing clique, not, you know, sort of a group, kind of a clique sort of thing.
Actually, at the time we were called the Sleepwalkers. It was me, Chamillionaire, and our boy PKT, Teray. He changed his name. I can't remember what he go by now, my boy. But yeah, my boy PKT, me and Chamillionaire, we were a group called the Sleepwalkers. But Michael Watts really didn't know PKT like that, the other member. And me and Chamillionaire were the ones that were always going to the Swisher House, doing stuff, getting involved with the Swisher House. PKT really didn't, he really didn't want to do the stuff with the Swisher House. Not like, he still listened to Swisher House, he loved the Swisher House, but he was more on some, man, let's build our own Swisher House, you know. And he wasn't wrong for feeling that way, but we just was, you know, we were happy to be a part of the Swisher House because they were our neighborhood heroes. So, you know, eventually, Watts just knew us, so he just kind of took us in the Swisher House, and he didn't really know PKT like that, and PKT didn't really just have a lot of interest in coming over there rapping like that with the Swisher House. So, you know, and then eventually we took that, and then 50-50 was our boy too. Both 50-50s, we went to school with him from middle school and junior high, all kind of, you know, so we knew him, and from we lived in the same neighborhood. And then the same with Lou Hawk, we knew him from, we lived in the same neighborhood. And then that's how we kind of formed the Color Changing Clique.
Color Changing Clique, it's home of Pimpson, baby. This your boy Paul Wall, and I brought some of my partners with me.
The Color Changing Clique was a group formed by Paul, Chamillionaire, and the aforementioned 50-50 Lil Twin in 1997. In addition to those three, the group's membership over the years has included Lou Hawk, Young Ro, and Cam's younger brother, Razak. The Sleepwalkers group that Paul mentioned as a predecessor to the Color Changing Clique does not have any recordings available. There is one song online credited to the Sleepwalkers and featuring Paul, but it's a different membership and much more recent.
It's the Color Changing Clique. Which car do I want to drive? Take a color changing pick. Y'all boys need to retire. Go sit next to Bill Walton. Because while we ballin', y'all will probably be still talking.
Garage like- and then eventually you and Chamillionaire did the duo thing,
yeah.
And Get Your Mind Correct was like this huge local hit.
Chamillionaire's better than me. His flip-flop shines a little bit wetter than me. But it don't matter, we're both on the same team. I'm thinking Thode and I know we think the same thing. I chopped the block like circumcision.
What was that like to do this record and then all of a sudden like it's a big thing in your city?
Well, the song, the main single for it was Big Swangers and Vogues, In Love With My Money.
I'm in love with my foreign, yes, I'm married to my dog. I'm in love with my money.
Hold up a second, man.
And that song, we didn't think it was going to be a single. We weren't making this song like this is going to be the single. We were making this song like it wasn't going to be the single. Because at the time, we were real hot. We didn't have any radio or airplay at all. But we were real, we were like the buzzing artists in the city, in the area. That you just, man, you every freestyle we did, people loved them. But it was kind of like Fabulous rapping on mixtapes before he had a radio single. So, you know, when we had our first radio single, it was kind of like we wanted to wait till it was our single for our album. We didn't want to come out on someone else's single and blow their stuff up or something. So we kind of, like a lot of the songs we were doing when people were asking us to do features, we were really kind of, you know, holding back a little bit, or we would pick beats that we wouldn't think would get played on the radio because they'd be too slow or too long or something. That's how big In Love With My Money was. It just was way too slow, was real long. We didn't do, you know, 3-16 bar verses or 2-16s, and we split the last one, and the hook's 8 bars. What we did was we did, like, 24 bar verses or 32 bar verses, something crazy, and the hook's, like, 24 bars. So it's just something different. We never thought that was going to get played on the radio. And the next thing you know, people started playing it. And really, that song was for a compilation. As a matter of fact, that song we did was for OG Ron C's compilation in Southern's Finest. And we just thought we was just doing a feature for our boy. We just thought, you know, but we just like, man, we don't want it on the radio because we want our song on the radio. But they ended up playing on the radio anyway. And it just took off anyway. And Ron C was so real. He's like, well, go ahead. That's y'all's song anyway. Y'all go ahead and keep it. You know what I'm saying? So it was like, damn,
and then,
man.
So then ended up on the tape.
Yeah. It was crazy how it, we tried to make a song so that they wouldn't play it on the radio. They ended up playing on the radio. And then it shows how real Ron C is. He was like, go ahead, y'all keep it too, man. It's y'all's song. Y'all did me a favor by putting it on here. But really, he did us a favor by putting us on. So, and so, you know what I'm saying? It was, when it caught, man, it was an incredible feeling because, you know, to have an album, you know, to have a mixtape success and have an album success is two different things and it's two different levels. So when you get to the next level of having an album that's successful and you sold over 100,000 units, 150,000 units independent, it's like, damn, man, you know, you really feel it. Like, you feel the love, you feel the movement, everything, and, you know, you just want to build on that and continue and keep it growing.
Yeah, and so I don't know when the last time you listened to that was, but when you go back and hear it, how does it sound to you? Your voice, to me, sounds like a little different, and your delivery's like a little faster in some places than you've done now.
I'm talking about them boys running from cops. They don't run their mouth. They too busy running their block. You better be fast, thinking you can run from a Glock. A snap, crackle, pop, soon as you run up, you get dropped.
Back in the days, man, I used to write differently than I do now. Well, when I would write songs, I would just write to the tempo of the song, and then I'd go in the corner or go in a room and I'd write it myself. I would think a lot about what I was writing and how I was saying, you know, everything. And sometimes it wouldn't come out like right. And like it'll sound good on paper in my head, but then when I go lay it to the beat, it'd be like it's too many words for the verse, you know what I'm saying? And that's kind of how it was. It was basically too many words for my verses because I was thinking too hard and putting too much into it. Just eventually I got better. I actually prayed on getting better. I said, man, I want to get better, man, so let me pray on this. I prayed that God would help me get better on it, and I just worked on it. I listened to people who I liked, and I was like, man, you know, let me see how they do their delivery. The people like Lil Kiki and Slim Thug, those are the main people, that I really listened to in terms of for their delivery and stuff, because Slim Thug especially had an incredible delivery with his voice, everything, the way he would say his words. Whatever he would say, it sounded tight saying it because he was coming out of him, you know what I'm saying, just because that's how he sound.
B-I-M-P-I-L-O-G. Ain't no record label pimping me the Slim Thug. I had to get my mind right before I get my grind right, making sure I shine bright when I'm in the spotlight.
So I was like, damn, man, Slim Thug sounds so thug, man. I got to change my delivery up a little bit. And I just kind of studied different people and practiced, and over time got better with it. But definitely back in them days, man, it was it's a big difference in a lot of that, in the delivery and the rhyming pattern and just everything.
And so you're in a group for a while. You do two records with him. And then you make Chick Magnet.
My hormones are driving me wild. Your slim waist and pretty smile are just my style. Why don't we kick it in the second gear? Have no fear, I'm in your ear. The Chick Magnet is here.
What was it like making a solo album without a partner for the first time?
It was a little different because when you with somebody, you're collaborating with them, bouncing ideas off of them. Sometimes he might come to the studio with an idea. Sometimes I come to the studio with an idea, but there's not as much pressure to do as many songs because you're in a group and it's a collaborative effort. But when you do a solo, it's like it's all on you. You got to come up with all the subject matters. You got to pick the beats. You got to, and we didn't have A&Rs, you know, doing this divorce. It was just us doing it. So, you know, it's whoever producers you mess with, you whatever beats you get from them, you know, hopefully you get a good beat and hopefully you come up with something good to it. And if you don't, then shit, on to the next one. So it's like, it was definitely a challenge. I wouldn't say it was a challenge. It was different. It was a different experience, and it was just something I had to learn.
You know, after that, you had this period where you kind of kept getting upstreamed, right? Because Swisha House had a deal with Asylum, with Atlantic, and so you did a record on Swisha House, a record on Asylum, and then a record on Atlantic. And it seemed almost like during that period, you know, not lyrically, but sonically, the records changed a little bit.
Check it out, baby. I got money. By visions and chains and diamond rings. I'm high as the moon and I'm fly than a mosquito. Stacking my chips, I got a bank full of Doritos. I'm too cool for school, so I'm teaching the class. Chiefing on that purple rain, partner, puff. I'm looking for a hot girl that like to A-Bay-Bay. Come out and play it, let me see you shake it this away. That Patron clears day, I'm on it hard, getting lit with my dogs, having a party with these broads. I'm on.
Did you feel pressure being upstream to sound different, make your record sound different? Like, what was that kind of three record period like?
There's so many dope producers. So sometimes I'll get like a couple beats from every different producer, and that's how I feel in the album. But the albums I look at that are like the dopest albums of all times or the dopest artists of all times, most of them or a lot of them had one or just a few producers who produced the whole thing. Like Tupac's albums. You know, a lot of his albums, Dre produced them with Hurt 'Em Bad and Daz. You know, and there's a couple other people here and there, but that's majority of the people who produce his tracks. Or, you know, UGK, Pimp C made a lot of their beats. You know what I'm saying? Or just, you know, Mike Dean and Mr. Lee made a lot of the Scarface beats. So, you know, it's like these albums were produced by one or two producers that, you know, or all the Cash Money albums were all produced by Manny Fresh. And when you have a single or one or two producers producing, it's like it brings that same theme for the album because you get a little bit of the same sound, even though, you know, every producer, well, not every producer, but even though, you know, a lot of producers can produce multiple styles and multiple sounds. You know, if it comes from the same producer, it's going to be something similar where it just ties it all together, kind of where there's a flow from song to song. So I just kind of was like, man, I want to work with, you know, different people. And the people at the time who I was working with was the Gridiron, my boy PT. He's still producing, and my boy Calvin. We had a studio together, and this is just a studio. PT and Calvin, I went to the University of Houston with them. That's where I had met them at, and they were, you know, they were just into hip-hop, and they wanted to produce. And I was into hip-hop, and I wanted to rap and DJ. So they started producing for other people like Lil O. They worked for Game. He worked for Game Face. My boy PT works for Game Face on the record label who signed Lil O and Big Hawk and a couple other people. So we had a studio at the Game Face Studios where we would record all our stuff, man. Our freestyles, our mixtapes. We would put a little, you know, stuff together, whatever. I was DJ over there. I had a radio show. You know, I would DJ on XM66 Raw. I would chop people's albums up, remix them up, man, stuff like that. So it was a lot of stuff I had going on at the studio, MPT produced. So that's where People's Champ came from. And Get Your Mind Correct was only one track from PT. And then Chick Magnet was like where he really produced like a bunch of it, most of it. Then the People's Champ, same
right,
with that.
He did like seven songs on that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like, it was just, you know, that same thing. It was that, you know, that same theme. And then on the next one, moving on, it was like, you know, I wanted to continue to have PT in them there, but also bring in new producers so that it sounds different or whatever. So the next one we went with Mr. Lee, with Get Money, Stay True. He produced most of that. But I still had some production from PT, all of them on there. All the people I messed with, they still came with me, you know, as time go on. But, you know, it's just, yeah, just you want to get better with time, but at the same time you want to use the tools. So I just used the tools that were around me, you know what I'm saying, and in each stage of the game, we just use different tools,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying, just to switch it up. But we still go back to the same tools just to, you know, keep that same, this, you know, keep it, the rotation going, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but you did see people in Houston, once Houston kind of broke nationally, you did see people in Houston, including people you were close to, like Slim Thug, go into this thing where they would work with the hot producers of the moment and maybe leave behind a little bit of what made them distinctive in Houston.
Yeah, and at the time, man, it's like we didn't realize the opportunities we had in front of us. You know, man, we didn't know, like I said, we didn't go to school for this, so we know how to hustle, you know what I'm saying? The music aspect of it was always like kind of secondary to the hustle, you know what I'm saying? So the music was just the product that we hustling. So we go in the studio and whip the product up and then go hustle it. So we didn't really look at it as serious as an art form and everything that we do now, where we, you know, we take a lot of responsibility on things now, how we do it with our music, with everything. So back then, we, you know, it's crazy because for Slim Thug to be able to do an album with Pharrell.
Hold up. Who you know wrote Billy for the album dropping, still got a few from Pharrell to make the album hot.
Yeah. When you think about it, it's like, man, that's kind of crazy, man, you know, because he just got producer of the year. Look at all the stuff he's doing, all the things he's producing. Man, Pharrell is just, man, he one of them people where he like a producer who just, you know, never go away, only get better with time, only work with bigger and better artists with time. It's like, damn, so just thinking back, for Slim Thug to be able to do the album with Pharrell is really amazing and incredible, you know what I'm saying? But at the time, we didn't, first of all, me and Kameen there at the time, we came from whatever you do is you pay for it yourself. You got to pay your own way with everything, with the promotion, with the production, with the mixing, the mastering, with everything. We pay our own way, which is something we was cool with because we didn't want someone else paying all this shit for us and then sending us a bill at the end of the day. You know what I'm saying? We did not want that. So we were more than happy. We wanted to pay our own way because then we don't owe nobody no money. When the records get sold, that money's coming to us. So that's what we was all about. So we didn't get no producers that was top notch or, you know, big name producers, because we was trying to keep our budget low so we wouldn't spend no money. We want to make money, you know. And we didn't look at it for the opportunity we had, because it's like now, well, I mean, now we got established name. A lot of times we can ask producers, and, you know, we still have opportunities. But I'm just saying, at that time, when you're the hot new artist coming out of the country and, you know what I'm saying, your city is the new popping city in the country, you know what I'm saying, your sound is a new popping sound, everybody want to mess with you, everybody want to, you know, do something with you. So, you know, those opportunities, they don't always come around like that. So, man, I definitely, at the time, I didn't really understand what Slim was doing, but, man, he, you know, I salute him for being able to do that, doing an album with Pharrell.
What was that like, what you talked about, Houston being, like, the hot new city, the hot new sound? Because for years, it was this super self-contained thing, right? You had essentially your own, like, hip-hop ecosystem, right? Your own clubs, your own labels. And then all of a sudden, like, it's all over the country in what at least seemed to the outside world like a second, you know, still tipping hits, and then all of a sudden it's everywhere. Yeah. What was that like for you kind of being in the middle of it?
I felt like a spokesperson for the culture, because every interview we do, we're turning people on to slang and, you know, the way we do things. So it's like every interview we do is like we got to explain the culture. But it was I took it as an opportunity to expose our culture, because a lot of people didn't know our culture. So the things we talk about in our music, the way we talk, the slang or the accent we have, a lot of it goes over people's head because they just don't understand what we're saying. And if they understood what we were saying, then they would look at the lyricism different. They would respect our skills and our talent and skill a little bit different. So that was what it was for me. It was like a translation. Everywhere I'm going, I'm exposing our culture and putting our culture on. But really, I'm just translating.
I've been learning that those are the rims that are on the tires, right?
Right, right. That's the swingers. We call them fours or threes. What Slim Thug saying and still tipping is, I'm still tipping on four foes wrapped in four vogues. Those are the tires.
Still tipping on still four tipping foes, on four wrapped in four vogues.
What we're doing is we...
So it just was, you know, it just... was an opportunity I took on, you know. I loved it. I enjoyed it, because that's one thing that I always repped and was proud of, is being from Texas. And that Texas culture, that Houston culture, is something that, you know, it's something I'm proud of to be from there, to represent. So to put on for it, it was a good deal for me.
Yeah, and you had a couple really big hits during that period, you know, of your own songs and of guest appearances. You know, obviously Still Tipping, Sitting Sideways, and even Grills as well.
I'm the people's champ. My chain light up like a lamp, cause now I'm back with the camp. Wow, baby, it's the people's champ. I'm something like a bowler. The candy paint dripping out for the old school Impala.
You're
a whole top diamond in the bottom rose gold. What it do, baby? It's the Iceman powwow. I got my mouth looking something like a disco ball. I got the diamonds in the ice all hand said. I might cause a cold front if I take a deep breath.
Huge singles.
Yeah, man, it's a blessing, man, and we always joke about...
Well, also, I have to ask, is it true that you really filmed the Grills video the day before your wedding?
Yep. Yeah. They were trying to take me to Magic City. It was like, you get married tomorrow? We taking you to Magic City? Come on. Well, I had to get back home to baby. Yeah, man. Yep. Matter of fact, the Grills story was a little crazy, man. Even when we recorded it, it was the day of the Hurricane Katrina relief concert they had in Atlanta. So it was a big ass concert. I flew down there, landed at 9 o'clock in Atlanta. Did my verse. Flew out at 4 a.m., 5 a.m. the next day. Just nonstop in the studio. We stayed in the studio till we were done, and went to the airport. So Usher was in the studio at the time, Jermaine Dupri, Nelly, everybody was there. So it just was an amazing time, man. I was very humbled to be there at Southside Studios, where they got 1,000 platinum plaques on the wall. You got like 5 or 6 diamond plaques, you know, like shit, you don't just get a diamond plaque, and Jermaine Dupri got a few of them.
Yeah.
So it was like, man, it was very, It also was a little intimidating at times to think, like, damn, man, I how am I going to hold my own amongst these heavyweights? You know, but I knew God, you know, put me there for a reason. He didn't put me there to strike out. So I just, it was like, hey, man, I got to do what I got
to
do.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of grills, that leads into something else I wanted to talk about, which is the business side of what you do.
Yeah.
Your jewelry business, the one you have with TV Johnny.
Diamond on my neck, on my wrist, on my ring. Diamond in my grill, man, I'm so real. Pressing B2BMC, man, he's so true.
How dependent is that on your rap career? I guess what I mean by that is, like, do you have to stay in the spotlight as a rapper in order to help out your jewelry business?
I think definitely the more I'm in the spotlight, it definitely helps the jewelry business out more. But it can sustain itself without me at all. Even if I was to stop rapping, period, or if I didn't have any ownership or partnership at all with the jewelry store or jewelry business at all, it still would be a success and would make a lot of money. But definitely we do see an increase of everything, you know, of sales, of the visibility of everything. Our presence is bigger, everything, whenever, you know, we got music out, and especially when it's hot music.
Right, because so, grills, yeah. During when grills was a hit, you guys were selling, like you said, 450 grills a day.
Yeah, it was, yeah, grills was a straight commercial for us. That's why I love Nelly, man. I love Nelly, man. Shit. Well, yeah, man, it was it basically was, you know, that's how it was, man. It was a commercial for us, man, and that's how it is now, too, you know, because this is me, my music, my album is out, and that gave me an opportunity to be here talking to you. Otherwise, I might not be in New York, you know what I'm saying? But I'm here, and I'm talking to you, and then we talking about grills. So, yeah. You know what I'm saying? It just is for real. Like, it's a, you know, it's just a way to expose all the products. I put a spotlight on all the products that I'm down with, and I endorse, or that I own, or, you know, whatever. So the music definitely is a big part of that. I looked at it, and I realized that a while back that, you know, because I always have been someone who had multiple hustles and multiple investments. But I realized and I recognized that definitely having the music out. So it's not like I realized that I wasn't going to retire from music and do some other stuff. It was going to always be, I'm going to keep making music, but I'm going to have other investments too. But the music got to keep coming too, because the music promote everything. When you got a new album out, even if the album is whack, if you got a whack album out, the fact that you got an album out puts you in front of people that you wouldn't have been in front of previously. You can do album release parties. You got new songs to sing. You got a video to promote. You can do a bunch of interviews. You know, so it gives you an opportunity to put a microphone and a spotlight on you. That's one reason why I was like, man, you know what? I'm not going to retire from the rap game, man. I'm going to keep putting this music out. So I started putting mixtapes out, you know, on my own, like No Sleep Tell Houston, Check Season, Poet. All those were mixtapes, too, where it was kind of like I was trying to find myself and find my identity. Or with No Sleep Tell Houston, that was the first mixtape I did after our deal was up. And so it was like, for me, it was like it meant something. No Sleep Tell Houston, I got to go back to my roots where this all started. You know, and I got to find myself. I got to find the balance of, you know, the old Houston with the new generation, with the how things have changed, you know, how he can hold the torch and carry on the traditions we have. But at the same time, you know, allow new people to have a chance to do their thing and allow Houston to have a opportunity to have, a, you know, new flavors and stuff. Got me two cups of drink,
I'm powwow, baby, call me two cups. Yup, boys hating, but I wouldn't give two fucks. No, two.
All of those things and stuff I was working out, you know, through the music. And a lot of that just come with, you just got to do it. You just got to go in there and record and get through it, you know. And,
yeah.
And eventually, as long as you keep working, a lot of, you know, sometimes it don't always work, but I feel like as long as you keep working and you keep trying and you keep praying, and something's going to happen. And that's how I work, it happened.
You mentioned endorsements there a minute ago. You have a ton of endorsements.
Yeah.
And how do you decide what to endorse? And is there ever a period where it's like, how much is too many? You know what I mean?
Sometimes it's just for the check. Somebody got a check for you, do it just for the check. But you can tell a lot of times when it's just for the check. You know what I'm saying? For me, the products I try to get down with, or, you know, any product I try to invest in or get sponsored by or own, is a product that's a part of my lifestyle already that I would use. So, like, clothes. You know, I wear clothes anyway. So, shit, I'm going to make a clothing line. vodka. I used to drink vodka all the time. Me and my boy Goo used to always drink vodka. So, you know, having a vodka company is something we always wanted, even though I don't drink vodka anymore that much. You know, I don't drink liquor at all that much anymore. I'm drinking other things. But I still, you know, it's something I always wanted to do. You know what I'm saying? So it's just a whole list of things that I wanted to, you know, do. So when the opportunity comes, if it's a good opportunity and it makes sense, I'm going to jump all over it.
Yeah. And so three of the endorsements, vaporizer, grinder, and rolling papers, are marijuana related. So all the discussions now around like medical marijuana and decriminalization, is that good for business?
Oh, hell yeah. You know, that's the only reason why I'm in the business now, is because of all the stuff that's going on, man. When I seen what Burna did with it, and, you know, of course, Snoop has always, you know, been the spokesman for the hip-hop weed community. He's been like the president of the hip-hop weed community. But just seeing what Burna's doing, though, with everything, with the strains, with the products, and with the branding of it, you know, he took something and made an empire out of it. And he showed us how to do it.
Bay Area rapper and marijuana entrepreneur Gilbert Burner Milam is well known for his association with the Cookie Family marijuana geneticists. Among their strains are Girl Scout Cookies and Sunset Sherbet. Additionally, he runs several related businesses that sell apparel, accessories, and paraphernalia. Burner is also signed to Taylor Gang, the label run by Wiz Khalifa.
These J's ain't out yet. No. Got my shoe plug, 2 or 3 ounces. Bag full of cash, so much I don't count it.
A lot of us was just, we were accepting of the fact that it was illegal and you couldn't do this, so we weren't going to do it because it's illegal. We was just scared to start a strain of weed. Even though we might have had one or came across a few here and there, it was like, man, hell no, nah, man. We going backwards. We going back to the trap with this, man. We going to go to jail. But, you know, Burner took it to another level. He, you know, he took it to a completely another level. And then, you know, so seeing that, seeing how he kicked the doors wide open, and it was just like, man, it was a matter of, man, listen, we got to do something too. We got to represent too. We got to come with our stuff, because we had something too. The Satellite OG was, it's been around since, you know, before 2005. It's been around since before 2000. It was been around, it's 2015 right now. It's been around over 15 years. So it's been around for a while. Satellite OG has just been on the streets and in the underground and called by different names. But my boys who started it, they reached out to me. They was already my homeboys when I'm in L.A., so I'm with every day. And they'd be like, hey, man, you know, we need you to help put us on. Like, you know, Burna put Girl Scout Cookie on, and, you know, how Burna putting, you know, the other strains on. We need you to help put us on. You a part of this, too. So, you know, and matter of fact, they called a Satellite because of one of the lines from one of my songs. That's how they gave it the name. And so it was like, man, that's how I got on board with that. Now I own a strain of weed.
Dr. Oz said Kush is better for you than kale. We'll crumble up the satellite. It's time to cure my ails.
You know, and then on top of that, we own an apparel company for a Satellite Supply Company. And then from that, we started doing other things like Trippy Sticks. I got my Trippy Stick collab. I got the Gold Leaf collab, or the Santa Cruz Shredders, or just, you know, we got a few others too. We got Rolling Trays. We got a bunch of things that are all just, you know, part of the marijuana lifestyle.
It seems like you're always looking for new opportunities and kind of unique things to do. I noticed, I think it was 2009, you were, as far as I could tell, the first person, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, to film a music video on an iPhone.
Yeah.
Was that your idea? Or?
Well, you know, I always had wanted to be the first at a lot of things. So, you know, for instance, if someone says anything, it's never been done, I'm going to sign up. Okay, I'll do it. You know, that's, if you want to get me to do something, just tell me it's never been done before and I'm going to try to do it. So my homeboy Amir, who was, he had shot Oh Girl, that video. Oh Girl, he shot that one. He shot a few of my other videos. He worked on some of them with my boy Dr. Teeth. And so, you know, he came to us with this idea. It was like, hey man, iPhone got this new, some new camera stuff where you can, it's the same quality as, you know, the cameras we use, and you can, you know, edit it and it's going to look like a good video. And I was like, I don't know, because at the time, man, the phones were pixelated. They didn't look too clear. He's like, nah, this is something new, man. It's going to look different. It's going to look new. It's going to look good. So I was like, all right, well, let's try it. Shit, I'll be the first, you know, be the first one to ever shoot a video on an iPhone. Okay, let's do it.
Yeah, and it got you some press. I saw up in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
And, you know, one final business thing.
Hey, we still ain't getting no free iPhones, though, man. Come on, Apple.
You don't need the 3GS anymore. Yeah, you gotta go upgrade from that.
Yeah.
One final business thing. You know, you've obviously made grills for a lot of famous people. Maybe the one that got the most attention was the American flag grill you made for Ryan Lochte,
yeah,
that they wouldn't let him wear on the podium at the 2012 Olympics.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
We had made some grills for him in the past, in the years past.
Right, you did one for him in 08, I think, that he wore, right?
Yeah, maybe even before that, too. I think 07. I don't know when the first one was, but at the time, first of all, swimming is not like a premier sport that you would see on ESPN. So, you know, it's not like we didn't think it was that big of a deal. Like, we thought it was dope. Like, damn, man, this swimmer's coming to us to get some grills, and he's a great swimmer, too. He's winning, too. He's not like a scrub, you know what I'm saying? So we thought that was thrill, though. But it was just like, you know, it's not the same as because no one else knew, you know what I'm saying? So it was like something where we got like a feather in our cap that we know about that nobody else really know about or nobody else really cared about. So then and the American flag idea was his idea. He wanted to put the American flag on. I want to, you know, it's the Olympics. I want to put an American flag in my grill. And, you know, so that's a huge honor because it's not like you just making something like a, you know, it's not like you just selling grills to somebody who walk in the shop. You know, this is an incredible honor because the Olympics, first of all, to go to the Olympics, to represent in the Olympics, be a part of that, you're putting on for your whole entire country. You know, you're inspiring people, you know what I'm saying, worldwide, but it's particularly in your country. So to be able to be a part of that as a rapper is like, man, there ain't no way to be a part of that. You know, so this was our way that we be a part of the Olympics, man. This boy got an American flag grill from us. And then when they told him not to put it in, he still put it on. He's like, all right, I'm not going to put it on. And then he turned around and put it in. He's like, shit. So that just, you know, for me, that just made me like, damn, man, I'm about representing. Because it just reminded me of something that would happen in rap and hip-hop. They tell you can't do something, you do it anyway. You know, that's how we do it. Shit, he tells us we can't do it. Oh, yeah, you performing at the BET Awards. You can't bring nobody on stage. We still brought, like, the whole hood with us. We had, like, 30 people on stage with us. So, you know, it's just like, I was like, damn, man, this boy, he put it on. Anyway, he still had it in his mouth, man, just as a rebellious thing or something. Or, you know, not in a negative light, but just on he wanted to represent for his country. And he was like, nah, y'all didn't pay too much money on this. You know what I'm saying? shit, I gotta represent for my country. And he put it on. And then, you know, after that, it was just like, you know, the response in the media was, grills are back. But, you know, to that point, we still was, you know, we were making a lot of grills a day, you know, but definitely after that, we got so many interviews, so much TV media coverage.
Ryan Lochte is known to rock a grill in his mouth as one of his signature trademarks, and he had a custom-made sparkling American flag mouthpiece made just for the 2012 Olympic Games.
I want to see the grill. Where's this famous thing you've got? You love this, don't you?
Oh, I do. I love it.
Your mother hates it.
I love it.
Your father? Do you
I
like
love it?
There's the top.
It's style. Oh, my God. There you go.
It's, how would you say, it's basically a retainer filled with diamonds. That's my grill. And I wear it when I go on the podium. It's just a unique way of showing my personality out to everyone. I have three grills. And I'm getting another one made for the Olympics. So stay tuned.
It was just like so many people saying, okay, yeah, I want some grills. I want some more grills. I need some grills. I always did want some grills. Yeah, man, let me get some grills. I want some grills. You know, it was, definitely went up.
And so you have the new album, Slab God.
Yep.
And there's one song on it that I wanted to talk to you about, which is the RIP Act, right? Which is about activists being taken off the market in large part because it was being sort of so glorified in songs and by people, you know, up to and including even like Justin Bieber, and the company took it off the market.
Can't say your name because I don't want to hurt no feelings. Never gonna forget you.
They say you're gone and you ain't coming back.
Activist was the high-end cough syrup that became the lean ingredient of choice for Justin Bieber, Soulja Boy, and many other rap figures. It was pulled off the market in April of 2014 by the manufacturer. At the time, a rep for Activist said that due to recent media attention, Activist has made the bold and unprecedented decision to cease all production and sales of its promethazine codeine product. This attention has glamorized the unlawful and dangerous use of the product, which is contrary to its approved indication. Shortly after the announcement, Soulja Boy posted a photo of 6 bottles on Instagram referencing the activist shortage. He wrote, "Soulja got the juice. They say the street's dry. I say you gotta be kidding me. I serve everybody." Unsurprisingly, a black market has developed for the scissor, with prices reportedly reaching well into the thousands for a bottle.
How did you feel when you heard it was going away?
Oh, man. First of all, we didn't believe it because people always say that. They would always say that, especially people trying to sell fake drink. Be like, oh, this is a new drink. You know, yeah, you know, they taking activists off the market. So we didn't believe it at first. We thought it was just rumors. And, man, come on, they've been saying that forever. And then they finally took it off the market. And even then, it was still, we were in complete denial because it was so many places we could still get it. People still had it. It's not like they took it off the market and had a recall. They just took it out. They just stopped making it. And the people who had it continued to sell it until they sold out. And that's how it fizzled out. So we were always like in denial, like, nah, it ain't gone, man. Nah, they just saying that. But when it finally did, man, it was like, damn, man. It was a combination of a bunch of thoughts. Some of the thoughts was, okay, well, maybe this is a sign from God that, you know, it's too much and we need to stop. You know, a lot of it was anger because in the Houston community, in the Texas community, we feel like, you know, the rappers before us or even us, we put it out there, but we didn't really call the brands out or first of all, there wasn't Instagram and stuff like that back then. So if there was, maybe we would have been showing our bottles, pulling up, all this kind of stuff, but there wasn't. So we didn't do that. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, we kind of looked at it as it was an underground thing, even though we talked about it.
But it was talked about almost in code, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was talked about in code. We all, you know, the people in Texas felt like and always feel like and still feel like very passionately that it's the people from out of town and the rappers from out of town, from outside of Texas, who glorified it to the point where they were putting the brand names on, they're putting the bottles in all their videos. And
I just took a piss and I seen coding coming out. We got purple activists, I thought it was a drought.
I'm a marijuana activist, but this activist got me leaning like, slow up, nigga.
I'm off this activist, it got me leaning over.
Part of that's true, but, you know, I got to be real, too. Well, yes, we were doing that, too, a little bit. You know what I'm saying? It's not like we were completely innocent of doing that. We were dry snitching on ourselves and exposing ourselves a little bit, too. But they just kind of, the other ones kind of took it a little farther than we did. So, you know what I'm saying? But I do got to take some responsibility, you know what I'm saying? But I will say that, man, the overwhelming feel in Texas is it's not our fault, it's their fault.
You know? Yeah. And you talked a lot about syrup in the past, your own use, and you've also had issues with food over the years, which now are corrected. But there was a connection there, right, between syrup and what you sometimes called, like, your addiction to food.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, of course, when you're leaning, you want to eat. You feeling good, you want to eat, you know what I'm saying? You want to eat good. And then just the whole lifestyle of it put together, man, you know, of not exercising, of eating greasy, fatty foods, you know, from the Tex-Mex, the barbecue, the chicken, everything that we eat, and all the Frenchies and Timmy Chan's we eating on a daily basis. And the only water we drink is the ice cubes in our cup. You know, it's like no exercise at all. So, we drinking soda all day nonstop. Not to mention whatever's in it. You know, this, I'm sure it's not good for you all the way. You know what I'm saying? But so it was just like, man, a combination of things that a whole lifestyle will catch up, you know, if you don't do something about it. And so it was just like, man, I got to do something about this, man. I can't be 300 plus pounds and sipping syrup, because you see other people that you hang around who are bigger than you. And you see pictures of them from the past when they was your size. And you see pictures, you know, a few years earlier than that. And they, you know, lighter than that, skinnier than that. And you see a few years earlier, they was, you know, skinny. And you look at this person who's like 400 pounds. And you're like, damn, this person used to be, you know, 190. You know what happened? And a lot of it is the lifestyle. But, you know, the serve has a lot to do with it. So it's like a conscious effort of, man, I got to make a life change of something. And but sip and serve didn't do it. Stop sip and serve didn't. It's like you stop sip and serve, it's not like you're gonna just lose your weight.
Right. You know? You said it was like your metabolism from a combination of syrup and then like diet pills to stave off what the syrup and lifestyle that had messed up your metabolism so much that you were basically unable to lose weight.
Yeah, definitely, man. I stopped sip and serve, wasn't drinking no alcohol, only drinking water. You know, only eating fish and rice and salads. You know what I'm saying? I'm talking about going a whole nine with it. You know what I'm saying? And after months, you do all that and you work, you're miserable. You feel miserable. You can't eat what you want to eat. You're starving. You know, after all of that, I only lose 2 pounds, 3 pounds. I'm running 5+ miles a day, sometimes 7 miles a day on a daily basis, every day, never missing a day. You know, it's like, damn, man, what's the problem? What's keeping me from losing this weight? I'm doing what I need to do. But every time I step on the scale, it's saying the same thing. You know, so it's just, that's how I go, man.
Yeah. Is it true, by the way, that so you ended up having surgery, gastric surgery. Yeah. Is it true that you no longer get hungry?
Yeah, nah. I get hungry a little bit, but yeah, mostly. Nah, I don't get hungry.
Wow. How do you know when to eat?
Like yesterday, man, we went the whole day doing interviews, man. I didn't eat nothing. I had had some Starbucks in the morning, and then when we was done and we got here, I had something to eat, you know, but that's all I ate the whole day. So, you know, you feel it in your body though. Like if you don't eat, you might feel a little irritable. You might feel, weak or something. Like, damn, I need to eat, man. I ain't ate all day. You know, so I was feeling that yesterday. Like, damn, I got to eat. But shit, we had to do interviews. It was either do an interview with Ebro at 97 or go eat. Shit, I'm gonna go do that interview.
97.
I'll eat later. Yeah.
So change topics a bit. A few weeks ago, I talked to Raquel Cepeda.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who directed Bling.
What's up?
Bling, A Planet Rock, is a 2007 documentary written and directed by next week's Cypher guest in episode 127, Raquel Cepeda. The film takes Paul, his business partner TV Johnny Dang, Raekwon, and Tego Calderon on a trip to Sierra Leone to learn about the diamond trade and the sometimes harrowing effects it has on the people of the country. Here's what Raquel had to say about how she saw it affect the artists.
At some point, I had to stop making eye contact with the people that were the guys that I brought because they were, it's like when you grow, you know, growing pains. It's like, it hurts, but you're doing it in front of a lot of people. And at the same time, you're a hip hop artist. So you're used to, like, in the beginning, you see Raekwon talking to the camera. You're used to, like, being in front of the camera. But this is so much of, like, this is like a tsunami of emotion, right? That it's, like, hard to process it. And you're actually breaking down and forgetting that the camera's even there. So it kind of makes you angry in some ways. Not angry at me, I didn't do it. But, like, just angry at what the situation. And the fact that I was placing them in that, in those moments, but I felt like it was important because through them, our audience was able to see. Is it more powerful for them to see me going through it, who they don't give a shit about, or these artists that they look up to? Nights in the grill, invisible top, class
bottom, swerving lanes on the interstate, evading laws and playing possum. So I've heard from her kind of what the filming was like and, you know, all of that. On your end, what was that trip to Sierra Leone like?
Man, it was amazing, man. It was funny though, man. My boy T. Ferris, my manager, he was like, he kind of didn't want me to go because he was like, man, I don't know, man. Paul gonna go out there, you know, rapping like Slim Thug, and he gonna come back rapping like Lupe Fiasco, you know, or it's gonna be, you know, not that that's a bad thing, but it's, you know, we know how to push the Paul Wall Slim Thug. We don't know how to push a Lupe Fiasco artist, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's like, damn, man, what are we gonna do if I come back being a conscious rapper and I don't, you know, I'm not wearing jewelry, I take my grill out? He was like, man, I do not want to. He told Raquel that too. I think he's like, man, I don't want Paul going over there if he coming back with his grill out and he ain't wearing chains and, you know, he got his tattoos removed or something. I don't know. He was like, so it was like but you never know what you are going to experience when you go over there and you see something like that. You know, some people just, you know, it's like going to for some people it's just like, you know, going on vacation or something. You just go into a new place, experience something new, and you come back home and you have your memories. But for me, it definitely affected me because I could see things, and, you know, it's just seeing people in like that, it's like, it opens your eyes up to a lot of things, you know what I'm saying? And I felt accountability. I felt a responsibility, and those are things that I started feeling after that. Like, damn, man, I'm not just out here living for me, trying to make as much money as I can make. And, you know, because that's my viewpoint at the time was, man, I'm gonna make as much money as I can make. Do what I gotta do. You know, it was about me because, you know, coming from the environment we come from. That's how you get it. You get as much as you can get, and you got to focus on you, and you don't worry about nothing else. But I felt that accountability, responsibility for everything I was doing, and it just made me grow up a little bit. And also at the time, I had just had my son, so it was a combination of a lot of things, a lot of growing up, and that trip really just helped me grow up. When I came back from that trip, I felt like, you know, I was in the process of growing up a lot more, you know, than I was before I went.
And what have been kind of the lasting things from that? I've heard, you know, you mentioned some kind of organizations that you've been working with and stuff like that. What's the status of that now?
Man, a lot of that stuff is fizzled out or gone away just because the organizations, people move on and stop doing things or they do whatever. But, man, you know, going over there, you meet, like, man, going with Raekwon and Tego Calderon and Raquel, we got, you know, friendships that are forever. The memories of the bonding we did was there forever. So it's kind of, man, I ain't even really thought about it for a while, man. Matter of fact, you bringing it up to me, man. Damn, because last time I talked to Raquel, we were talking about going to Vietnam and doing something different, doing a different type of documentary over in Vietnam. Because when Johnny came with me, he was like, man, this looked just like Vietnam. Everywhere he was going, he's like, man, this is exactly how my village looked growing up. And he was like, damn. And it was like, you know, it kind of like was a nostalgic type of feeling you could see in Johnny going over there. So, you know, you could see that same, you know, accountability coming in him. And after that, that's when he started doing things like he started his Johnny Dang charities for his people back in Vietnam. He was doing, he's doing a few different things. But, you know, just that whole trip in general just made us grow up, man. And I really want to go back though, man, because I've been curious of how things have changed, if they've changed at all. I don't think they've really changed too much. Because when we were there, you know, it was like we were meeting with people trying to see how we can help. And they telling us, well, this is how you can help. You can invest in buying some hotels, you know. And we're like, damn, we didn't come here for no, you know, investment properties, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, but this is how I go, you know. But I definitely hope I get a chance to go back.
Yeah, that was such a crazy movie to watch, you know, to watch kind of what ended up coming out of it because of... You can actually see stuff hitting you, you know, hitting the artist as you're going through it. Like, you're having all these realizations about, like, class and the war and the aftermath of the war and stuff like that.
Whenever the war was going on, they got sexually abused and raped, and it happened on a consistent basis. You know, and the war ended, you know, like 4 or 5 years ago. So that means these kids, these girls were like 10, 11 years old whenever they got raped and got sexually abused. And it just, you know, seeing how they are today, you know, it's just hard to put yourself in their shoes and just to see how they feel. And sometimes you could just look in their eyes and tell that they just, you know, just hide all their emotions. Just like they were just stone cold faces. They just had these stone cold faces that you could just see right through. And it was just scary seeing that. And, you know, coming from, you know, the history I have, you know, my mother, she was raped. She was sexually assaulted. She was molested, you know, on numerous occasions when she was younger. And then when she grew up to be, you know, how old they are. So, you know, it's just like every time I see any one of these girls, I see my mom. And just knowing all the pain I know my mom went through, you know, she still feel pain to this day. She's affected by it.
And as far as like the diamond trade goes, it seems like you've become pretty knowledgeable about what a conflict diamond is and isn't, and where, you know, how to source diamonds and stuff since that trip.
Man, before Kanye West came out with the song Diamonds Are Forever.
Lose hands, legs, arms for real. Little was known as Sierra Leone and how we connect to the diamonds we own. When I speak of diamonds,
both Raquel Cepeda's bling and Q-Tip played a role in the genesis of Kanye's Diamonds from Sierra Leone. Tune in next week to episode 127 to find out more.
Saying keep shining, how when I know what a blood diamonds, though it's thousands of miles away. Sierra Leone connect to what we go through today over here.
I had never even heard of Sierra Leone. I had never even heard of a conflict diamond or any of that. I didn't even know it existed. So salute to Kanye for that, because he turned a lot of people on to something that we didn't even know about. We didn't even know it existed. So, you know, after that, especially after going over there, it's just something like, damn, we had no idea this was like this. You know what I'm saying? So it definitely made us change a lot of things. For instance, like who we got our diamonds from, our diamond wholesaler, they didn't abide by the Kimberly process. That don't mean they had diamond, conflict diamonds. That just mean they just, you know, had them on the black market. You know, they sold them under the table. You know what I'm saying? Lots of people do that. Lots of diamond dealers do that. But we didn't even know the difference. So after that, it was like, well, shit, we not finna, you know, be supporting this. We going to somebody who at least doing that. But I also learned, too, that, you know, with anything, there's ways around it, man. There's, you know what I'm saying? So even if you go through the Kimberly process, it still could very easily be a conflict diamond. If you got some, you know, 100 people with all type of rifles forcing you to do something, or they come rob you, and then they take it to the people and register it and say, look, if you tell on us, we're going to kill you and your whole family. That, you know, that's a conflict diamond too, but it still came through the Kimberly process. So, you know, and I mean, I'm not just saying all of it go like that, but there's things that be happening, where, you know, where there's definitely still conflict diamonds.
Yeah. And, you know, one final thing. So you said once that in an interview, you said, I missed a lot of my opportunities because of Texas thinking, but I got a lot of opportunities because of Texas thinking. For people not from there, what did you mean by Texas thinking?
There's a, you know, we have a something we refer to as a Texas hustle, where we just, you got to go out there and get it. You are what you make. You're not an artist for someone else to work you. You're an artist because you're an artist and CEO. Without being a CEO, that's really what you're doing. You know, just, and that's just in terms of the music side, but just overall, just that Texas hustle is something that, you know, we were just, you taught, and you just, it's something that you grow up with that grows on you, because growing up in Texas, you're so far away from, you know, mainstream media. Most people, you know, a lot of tours don't even come through Texas. We just got a House of Blues a few years ago in Houston. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, picture all the House of Blues artists who did House of Blues tours that never came through Houston over the years. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, we still would get concerts, but Houston was always notorious for canceling concerts because of low ticket sales. Because Houston's a walk-up city, so they would always do that anyway. They would walk up at the last minute, and the concert might sell out. You know what I'm saying? But the concert promoters would cancel a lot of concerts, man. So artists wouldn't come through there. Celebrities didn't really come through there. People, when they talked about Texas, they talked down on it. Like, you know, we were still riding horses and cows, and we were cowboys, and you know, it was just, you know, it just how it was just the perception of Texas, at least how we felt the perception of Texas. It wasn't a good one, man. People didn't, there wasn't a lot of stars coming out of Texas, superstars, and the superstars that were there, they could only be superstars if they moved out of Texas and moved to Hollywood or moved somewhere else. You couldn't be a superstar and still live in Texas. You know, we didn't see that. You know, the only people we saw that from was our underground rap artists. You know what I'm saying? But other than that, we didn't see that. But so them things made us, they forced us to go hustle, forced us to hit the road and work harder and make our own connections and build our own networking up. So that Texas hustle is just something that, you know, is just something we got. But the Texas mentality of it is also is that, you know, Texas is better. We are taught that, you know, like we got Texas history growing up all through school, from elementary to high school. One of your classes is Texas history. They're going to teach you Texas history. They always teach you all the commercials, everything, all the products that come out of Texas are all about promoting Texas pride. And, you know, everything's bigger in Texas. And if it comes from Texas, then it's better, because they don't fuck with us. So no one else fuck with us in all these other cities. So we only fuck with Texas shit, you know, and that type of we only keep to ourselves mentality. You know, it forces you to be closed minded a little bit when it comes to things outside of your realm and your culture, you know. So, you know, that's part of the stuff with Slim Thug and Pharrell. Like, I might not have did that at the time because I was closed-minded, but he did it, you know what I'm saying? And that's what, you know, and that helped him out, you know, a lot.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Paul Wall, Slab God, out now.
Already.
All right. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, man.
One of the things I most enjoy about this show is the ability to dig deep into regional rap scenes. We've done it for New Orleans with Mystical and Lil Slim, for Columbus with RJD2 and Blueprint, and we continue to do it for Houston with Paul, Scarface, Michael Watts, and our episode 59 guest, journalist Lance Scott Walker, co-author of the books Houston Rap and Houston Rap Tapes. I was glad to get the inside scoop this week into not only Paul's style and sound, but his career trajectory as well. Join us next week when our guest will be Raquel Cepeda. Raquel is an author, filmmaker, journalist, podcast host, and lots more, including a champion boxer. Her 2007 film Bling, A Planet Rock, which you heard about this week, features Paul Wall and other artists finding out firsthand about the diamond trade in Sierra Leone. We discuss that film, her memoir Bird of Paradise, How I Became Latina, her history in the spoken word and hip-hop scenes of the New York City of the 90s, and tons more. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More info about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
This was our way that we'd be a part of the Olympics, man.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Sometimes it's just for the check. Somebody got a check for you, do it just for the check. But you can tell a lot of times when it's just for the check.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Man, that's kind of crazy, man, you know, because he just got producer of the year.
Special thanks to our Patreon supporter of the week, Gino from Bookshelf Beats.
It's not our fault, it's their fault.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Ha 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 ha.